Right beneath the blue-white expanse of ice and snow slopes that stretched up and out of sight to the blue zenith, looked like altars. What Aeneas had pointed out was a great white stone set next to the trail, with this poem carved in its smooth face. With what can I compare the great peak? Over the surrounding provinces, its blue-green hue never dwindles from sight. Infused by the shaper of forms with the soaring power of divinity, shaded and sunlit, its slopes divide night from day. Breast heaving as I climb toward the clouds, eyes straining to follow birds flying home, someday I shall reach its peerless summit and behold all mountains in a single glance. Tu Fu, Tang Dynasty, China, Old Earth. And so we entered Tai'an, the city of peace. There on the slopes were the scores of temples, hundreds of shops, inns, and homes, countless small shrines, and a busy street filled with stalls, each covered by a bright canvas awning. The people here were lovely. That is a poor word, but the only proper one, I think. All with dark hair, bright eyes, gleaming teeth, healthy skin, and a pride and vigor to their carriage and step. Their clothes were silk and dyed cotton, bright but elegantly simple. And there were many, many monks in orange and red robes. The crowds would have been forgiven if they had stared. No one visits Taishan during the monsoon months. But all the glances I saw were welcoming and easy. Indeed, many of the people in the street milled around, greeting Aeneas by name and touching her hand or sleeve. I remembered then that she had visited the great peak before. Aeneas pointed out the great slab of white rock that covered a hillside above the City of Peace. On the polished face of that slab had been carved what she explained was the Diamond Sutra in huge Chinese characters. One of the principal works of Buddhist philosophy, she explained. It reminded the monk and passerby of the ultimate nature of reality, as symbolized in the empty expanse of blue sky overhead. Aeneas also pointed out the first heavenly gate at the edge of the city, a gigantic stone archway under a red pagoda roof, with the first of the 27,000 steps starting up toward the jade summit. Incredibly, we had been expected. In the great gompa at the center of the City of Peace, more than 1,200 red-robed monks sat cross-legged in patient files, waiting for Aeneas. The resident lama greeted Aeneas with a low bow. She helped him to his feet and hugged the old man. And then Abetic and I were sitting at one side of the low, cushioned dais, while Aeneas briefly addressed the waiting multitude. "I said last spring that I would return at this time," she said softly, her voice perfectly clear in the great marble space. "And it pleases my heart to see you all again. For those of you who took communion with me during my last visit, I know that you have discovered the truth of learning the language of the dead, of learning the language of the living, and, for some of you, of hearing the music of the spheres, and soon, I promise you, of taking that first step. This day is a sad day in many ways, but our future is bright with optimism and change. I am honored that you have allowed me to be your teacher. I am honored that we have shared our exploration of a universe that is rich beyond imagining." She paused and looked at Abetic and me. "These are my companions, my friend Abetic and my beloved Rawl Endymion. They have shared all hardships of my longest life's voyage with me, and they will share in today's pilgrimage. When we leave you, we will pass this day through the three heavenly gates, enter the mouth of the dragon, and, Buddha and the fates of chaos willing, shall visit the princess of azure clouds and see the temple of the Jade Emperor this day." Aeneas paused again and looked at the shaven heads and bright dark eyes. These were not religious fanatics I saw, not mindless servants or self-punishing ascetics, but were instead row upon row of intelligent, questioning, alert young men and women. I say young, but among the fresh and youthful faces were many with gray beards and subtle wrinkles. My dear friend the Lama tells me that there are more now who wish to share in communion with the void which binds this day, said Anea. About 100 of the monks in the front rows went to their knees. Anea nodded. So it shall be, she said softly. The Lama brought flagons of wine and many simple bronze cups. Before filling the cups or lancing her finger for the drops of blood, Anea said, But before you partake of this communion, I must remind you that this is a physical change, not a spiritual one. Your individual quest for God or enlightenment must remain just that, your individual quest. This moment of change will not bring Satori or salvation. It will bring only change. My young friend held up one finger, the finger she was about to prick to draw blood. In the cells of my blood are unique DNA and RNA arrangements, along with certain viral agents which will invade your body, starting through the digestive lining of your stomachs and ending in every cell of your body. These invasive viruses are somatic, that is, they shall be passed along to your children. I have taught your teachers, and they have taught you that these physical changes will allow you, after some training, to touch the void which binds more directly, thus learning the language of the dead and of the living. Eventually, with much more experience and training, it may be possible for you to hear the music of the spheres and take a true step elsewhere. She raised the finger higher. This is not metaphysics, my dear friends. This is a mutant viral agent. Be warned that you will never be able to wear the cruciform of the Pax, nor will your children nor their children's children. This basic change in the soul of your genes and chromosomes will ban you from that form of physical longevity forever. This communion will not offer you immortality, my dear friends. It ensures that death will be our common end. I say again, I do not offer you eternal life or instant Satori. If these are the things you seek most dearly, you must find them in your own religious searchings. I offer you only a deepening of the human experience of life and a connection to others, human or not, who have shared that commitment to living. There is no shame if you change your mind now, but there is duty, discomfort, and great danger to those who partake of this communion and, in so doing, become teachers themselves of the void which binds, as well as fellow carriers of this new virus of human choice. Anea waited, but none of the 100 monks moved or left. All remained kneeling, heads slightly bowed as if in contemplation. So be it, said Anea. I wish you all well. And she pricked her finger, squeezing a droplet of blood into each prepared cup of wine held out by the elderly Lama. It took only a few minutes for the 100 monks to pass the cups down their rows, each drinking but a drop. I rose from my cushion then, determined to go to the end of the row nearest me and partake of this communion, but Anea beckoned me to her. Not yet, my dear, she whispered in my ear, touching my shoulder. I was tempted to argue. Why was I being excluded from this? But instead returned to my place next to Abetic. I leaned over and whispered to the android. You haven't done this so-called communion, have you? The blue man smiled. No, Emendymion, and I never shall. I was about to ask why, but at that moment the communion ended. The 1,200 monks rose to their feet. Anea walked among them, chatting and touching hands, and I saw from her glance toward me over shaven heads that it was time for us to leave. Nemes, Scylla, and Briareus regard the shrike across the expanse of the suspension bridge, not phase-shifting for a moment, appreciating the real-time view of their enemy. It's absurd, says Briareus, a child's boogeyman. All spikes and thorns and teeth, how silly. Tell that to Gyges, responds Nemes. Ready? Ready, sends Scylla. Ready, sends Briareus. The three phase shift in unison. Nemes sees the air around them go thick and heavy, light becoming a sepia syrup, and she knows that even if the shrike now does the obvious, cutting the suspension bridge supports, that it will make no difference. In fast time, it will take ages for the bridge to begin to fall. Time enough for the trio to cross it 1,000 times. In single file, Nemes leading, they cross it now. The shrike does not change position. Its head does not move to follow them. Its red eyes gleam dully like crimson glass reflecting the last bit of sunset.
"Something's not right here," sends Briareus.
"Quiet," commands Nemes. "Stay off the common band unless I open contact." She is less than 10 meters from the shrike now, and still the thing has not reacted. Nemes continues forward through thick air until she steps onto solid stone. Her clone sister follows, taking up position on Nemes's left. Briareus steps off the bridge and stands on Nemes's right. They are 3 meters in front of the Hyperion legend. It remains quiescent.
"Move out of the way or be destroyed,"
Nemes shifts down long enough to speak to the chrome statue.
"Your day is long past. The girl is ours today."
The shrike does not respond.
"Destroy it,"
Nemes commands her siblings, and phase shifts. The shrike disappears, shifting through time. Nemes blinks as the temporal shockwaves ripple over and through her, and then surveys the frozen surroundings with the full spectrum of her vision. There are a few human beings still here at the temple hanging in air, but no shrike.
"Shift down,"
she commands, and her siblings obey immediately. The world brightens, the air moves, and sound returns.
"Find her," says Nemes.
In a full jog, Scylla moves to the noble eightfold path axis of wisdom and lopes up the staircase to the platform of right understanding. Briareus moves quickly to the axis of morality and leaps to the pagoda of right speech. Nemes takes the third stairway, the highest, toward the high pavilions of right mindfulness and right meditation. Her radar shows people in the highest structure. She arrives in a few seconds, scanning the buildings and cliff wall for concealed rooms or hiding places. Nothing. There is a young woman in the pavilion for right meditation, and for an instant Nemes thinks that the search is over. But although she is about the same age as Anea, it is not her. There are a few others in the elegant pagoda. A very old woman. Nemes recognizes her as the thunderbolt sow from the Dalai Lama's reception. The Dalai Lama's chief crier and head of security, Kar Lingo William Ihagee, and the boy himself, the Dalai Lama.
"Where is she?" says Nemes. "Where is the one who calls herself Anea?"
Before any of the others can speak, the warrior Ihagee reaches into his cloak and hurls a dagger with lightning speed. Nemes dodges it easily. Even without phase shifting, her reactions are faster than most humans. But when Ihagee pulls a flechette pistol, Nemes shifts up, walks to the frozen man, encloses him in her shift field, and flings him out the open floor-to-ceiling window into the abyss. Of course, as soon as Ihagee leaves her field envelope, he seems to freeze in midair, like some ungainly bird thrown from the nest, unable to fly but unwilling to fall. Nemes turns back to the boy and shifts down. Behind her, Ihagee screams and plummets out of sight. The Dalai Lama's jaw drops and his lips form an O. To him and the two women present, Ihagee had simply disappeared from next to them and reappeared in midair out the open shoji doors of the pavilion, as if he had chosen to teleport to his death.
"You can't," begins the old thunderbolt sow. "You are forbidden," begins the Dalai Lama.
"You won't," begins the woman, whom Nemes guesses is either Rachel or Theo, Anea's compatriots. Nemes says nothing. She shifts up, walks to the boy, folds her phase field around him, lifts him, and carries him to the open door.
"Nemes!"
It is Briareus calling from the pavilion of right effort.
"What?"
Instead of verbalizing on the common band, Briareus uses the extra energy to send the full visual image.
looking frozen in the sepia air kilometers above them, fusion flame as solid as a blue pillar. A spaceship is descending. "Shift down," commands Nemes. The monks and the old lama packed us a lunch in a brown bag. They also gave Abedic one of the old-fashioned pressure suits of the kind I had seen only in the ancient spaceflight museum at Port Romance, and tried to give two more to Aenea and me, but we showed them the skin suits under our thermal jackets. The 1,200 monks all turned out to wave us off through the first heavenly gate, and there must have been 2,000 or 3,000 others pressing and craning to see us leave. The great stairway was empty, except for the three of us, climbing easily now. Abedic with his clear helmet folded back like a cowl. Aenea and me with our osmosis masks turned up. Each of the steps was 7 meters wide, but shallow. And the first section was easy enough, with a wide terrace step every 100 steps. The steps were heated from within, so even as we moved into the region of perpetual ice and snow, midway up Taishan, the stairway was clear. Within an hour we had reached the second heavenly gate, a huge red pagoda with a 15-meter archway. And then we were climbing more steeply up the near-vertical fault line known as the Mouth of the Dragon. Here the winds picked up, the temperature dropped precipitously, and the air became dangerously thin. We had redonned our harnesses at the second heavenly gate, and now we clipped onto one of the bucky carbon lines that ran along each side of the staircase, adjusting the pulley grip to act like a brake if we fell or were blown off the increasingly treacherous staircase. Within minutes, Abedic inflated his clear helmet and gave us a thumbs up, while Aenea and I sealed our osmosis masks. We kept climbing toward the south gate of heaven still a kilometer above us, while the world fell away all around. It was the second time in a few hours that such a sight had presented itself to us, but this time we took it all in every 300 steps as we took a break, standing and wheezing and staring out at the early afternoon light illuminating the great peaks. Taian, the city of peace, was invisible now, some 15,000 steps and several clicks below the ice fields and rock walls through which we had climbed. I realized that the skin suit comm threads gave us privacy once again, and said, "How you doing, kiddo?" "Tired," said Aenea. But she leavened the comment with a smile from behind her clear mask. "Can you tell me where we're headed?" I said. "The Temple of the Jade Emperor," said my friend. "It's on the summit." "I guess that," I said, setting a foot down on the wide step, then raising the next foot to the next step. The stairway passed up and through a rock and ice overhang at this point. I knew that if I turned around to look down, that vertigo might overcome me. This was infinitely worse than the paragliding. "Can you tell me why we're climbing to the Temple of the Jade Emperor, when everything is going to hell behind us?"
"How do you mean going to hell?" she said.
"I mean Nemes and her ilk are probably after us. The Pax definitely is going to make its move. Things are falling apart, and we're on pilgrimage." Aenea nodded. The wind was roaring now, as thin as it was, as we actually climbed into the jet stream. Each of us was moving forward and up, with our heads bowed and our bodies arched, as if carrying a heavy load. I wondered what Abedic was thinking about. "Why don't we just call the ship and get the hell out of here," I said. "If we're going to bail out, let's get it over with." I could see Aenea's dark eyes behind the mask that reflected the deepening blue sky. "When we call the ship, there'll be 24 Pax warships descending on us like harpy crows," said Aenea. "We can't do it until we're ready." I gestured up the steep staircase.
"And climbing this will make us ready?"
"I hope so," she said softly. I could hear the rasp of her breathing through my ear patches. "What's up here, kiddo?" We had reached the next 300th step. All three of us stopped and panted, too tired to appreciate the view. We had climbed into the edge of space. The sky was almost black. Several of the brighter stars were visible, and I could see one of the smaller moons hurtling toward the zenith. Or was it a packed ship?
I don't know what we'll find, Rawl, said Anea, her voice tired. I glimpse things, dream things again and again. But then I dream the same thing in a different way. I hate to talk about it until I see which reality presents itself.
I nodded understanding, but I was lying. We began climbing again.
Anea, I said.
Yes, Rawl.
Why don't you let me take, you know, communion? She made a face behind the osmosis mask.
I hate calling it that.
I know, but that's what everyone calls it. But tell me this, at least. Why don't you let me drink the wine?
It's not time for you to, Rawl.
Why not? I could feel the anger and frustration just below the surface again, mixing with the roiling current of love that I felt for this woman.
You know the four steps I talk about? She began.
Learning the language of the dead, learning the language of the living. Yeah, yeah, I know the four steps, I said, almost dismissively, setting my very real foot on a very physical marble step and taking another tired pace up the endless stairway. I could see Anea smile at my tone.
Those things tend to preoccupy the person first encountering them, she said softly. I need your full attention right now. I need your help.
That made sense to me. I reached over and touched her back through the thermal jacket and skin suit material. Abedic looked across at us and nodded, as if approving of our contact. I reminded myself that he could not have heard our skin suit transmissions.
Anea, I said softly, are you the new Messiah?
I could hear her sigh.
No, Rawl. I never said I was a Messiah. I never wanted to be a Messiah. I'm just a tired young woman right now. I've got a pounding headache and cramps. It's the first day of my period.
She must have seen me blink in surprise or shock. Well, hell, I thought, it's not every day that you get to confront the Messiah, only to hear that she's suffering from what the ancients used to call PMS.
Anea chuckled.
I'm not the Messiah, Rawl. I was just chosen to be the one who teaches, and I'm trying to do it while I can.
Something about her last sentence made my stomach knot in anxiety.
Okay, I said.
We reached the 300th step and paused together, wheezing more heavily now. I looked up, still no south gate of heaven visible. Even though it was midday, the sky was space black. 1,000 stars burned. They barely twinkled. I realized that the hiss and roar of the jet stream had gone away. Taishan was the highest peak on Tian Shan, extending into the highest fringes of the atmosphere. If it had not been for our skin suits, our eyes, eardrums, and lungs would have exploded like overinflated balloons. Our blood would be boiling. I tried to shift my thoughts onto something else.
All right, I said. But if you were the Messiah, what would your message to humanity be?
Anea chuckled again. But I noticed that it was a reflective chuckle, not a derisive one.
If you were a Messiah, she said between breaths, what would your message be?
I laughed out loud. Abedic could not have heard the sound through the near vacuum separating us, but he must have seen me throw my head back, for he looked over quizzically. I waved at him and said to Anea, I have no fucking clue.
Exactly, said Anea. When I was a kid, I mean a little kid before I met you, and I knew that I'd have to go through some of this stuff, I was always wondering what message I was going to give humankind. Beyond the things I knew I'd have to teach, I mean. Something profound, sort of a Sermon on the Mount.
I looked around. There was no ice or snow at this terrible altitude. The clear white steps rose through shelves of steep black rock.
Well, I said, here's the mount.
Yeah, said Anea,
and I could hear the fatigue once again.
So what message did you come up with?
I said, more to keep her talking and distracted than to hear the answer. It had been a while since she and I had just talked. I could see her smile.
I kept working on it, she said at last, trying to get it as short and important as the Sermon on the Mount. Then I realized that was no good, like Uncle Martin in his manic poet period trying to outwrite Shakespeare. So I decided that my message would just be shorter. How short? I got my message down to 35 words. Too long. Then down to 27. Still too long. After a few years, I had it down to 10. Still too long. Eventually, I boiled it down to 2 words.
2 words, I said. Which two?
We had reached the next resting point, the 70th or 80th 300th step. We stopped gratefully and panted. I bent over to rest my skin-suit-gloved hands on my skin-suit-sheathed knees and concentrated on not throwing up. It was bad form to vomit in an osmosis mask.
Which two?
I said again, when I got some wind back and could hear the answer over my pounding heart and rasping lungs.
Choose again, said Aenea.
I considered that for a wheezing, panting moment.
Choose again?
I said finally. Aenea smiled. She had caught her wind and was actually looking down at the vertical view that I was afraid even to glance toward. She seemed to be enjoying it. I had the friendly urge to toss her off the mountain right then. Youth, it's intolerable sometimes.
Choose again, she said firmly.
Care to elaborate on that?
No, said Aenea. That's the whole idea. Keep it simple. But name a category and you get the idea.
Religion, I said.
Choose again, said Aenea.
I laughed. I'm not being totally facetious here, Rawl, she said. We began climbing again. Abetic seemed lost in thought.
I know, kiddo, I said, although I had not been sure.
Categories,
political systems.
Choose again. You don't think that the Pax is the ultimate evolution of human society? It's brought interstellar peace, fairly good government, and, oh yeah, immortality to its citizens.
It's time to choose again, said Aenea. And speaking of our views of evolution...
What?
Choose again.
Choose what again, I said. The direction of evolution?
No, said Aenea. I mean our ideas about whether evolution has a direction. Most of our theories about evolution, for that matter.
So do you or don't you agree with Pope Teilhard, the Hyperion pilgrim, Father Duray, when he said 3 centuries ago that Teilhard de Chardin had been right, that the universe was evolving toward consciousness and a conjunction with the Godhead, what he called the Omega Point?
Aenea looked at me.
You did do a lot of reading in the Taliesin Library, didn't you?
Yeah.
No, I don't agree with Teilhard, either the original Jesuit or the short-lived Pope. My mother knew both Father Doré and the current pretender, Father Hoyt, you know.
I blinked. I guess I had known that, but being reminded of the reality of it, of my friends' connections across the last 3 centuries, set me back a bit.
Anyway, continued Aenea, evolutionary science has really taken a bite in the butt over the last millennium. First, the Corps actively opposed investigation into it because of their fear of rapid human-designed genetic engineering, an explosion of our species into variant forms upon which the Corps could not be parasitic. Then evolution and the biosciences were ignored by the hegemony for centuries because of the Corps' influence, and now the Pax is terrified of it.
Why? I said.
Why is the Pax terrified of biological and genetic research?
No, I said, I think I understand that. The Corps wants to keep human beings in the form and shape they're comfortable with, and so does the Church. They define being human largely by counting arms, legs, and so forth. But I mean, why redefine evolution? Why open up the argument about direction or non-direction and so forth? Doesn't the ancient theory hold up pretty well?
No, said Aenea. We climbed several minutes in silence. Then she said, except for mystics such as the original Teilhard, most early evolution scientists were very careful not to think of evolution in terms of goals or purposes.
That was religion, not science. Even the idea of a direction was anathema to the pre-Hegira scientists. They could only speak in terms of tendencies in evolution, sort of statistical quirks that kept recurring. So that was their short-sighted bias, just as Teilhard de Chardin's was his faith. There are directions in evolution.
How do you know?
I said softly, wondering if she would answer. She answered quickly. Some of the data I saw before I was born, she said, through my cybered father's connections to the core. The autonomous intelligences there have understood human evolution for many centuries, even while humans stayed ignorant. As hyper-hyper-parasites, the AIs evolve only toward greater parasitism. They can only look at living things and their evolutionary curve and watch it, or try to stop it.
So what are the directions in evolution? I asked. Toward greater intelligence? Toward some sort of godlike hive mind?
I was curious about her perception of the lions and tigers and bears.
Hive mind, said Aenea. Ugh, can you conceive of anything more boring or distasteful?
I said nothing. I had rather imagined that this was the direction of her teachings about learning the language of the dead and all that. I made a note to listen better the next time she taught.
Almost everything interesting in the human experience is the result of an individual experiencing, experimenting, explaining, and sharing, said my young friend. A hive mind would be the ancient television broadcasts, or life at the height of the datasphere, consensual idiocy.
Okay, I said, still confused. What direction does evolution take?
Toward more life, said Aenea. Life likes life. It's pretty much that simple. But more amazingly, non-life likes life as well, and wants to get into it.
I don't understand, I said.
Aenea nodded. Back on pre-Hegira Old Earth, in the 1920s, there was a geologist from a nation-state called Russia who understood this stuff. His name was Vladimir Vernadsky, and he coined the phrase biosphere, which, if things happen the way I think they will, should take on new meaning for both of us soon.
Why? I said.
You'll see, my friend, said Aenea, touching my gloved hand with hers. Anyway, Vernadsky wrote in 1926, atoms, once drawn into the torrent of living matter, do not readily leave it. I thought about this for a moment. I did not know much science. What I had picked up came from Grandam and the Taliesin Library, but this made sense to me. It was phrased more scientifically 1,200 years ago as Dalo's Law, said Aenea. The essence of it is that evolution doesn't back up. Exceptions like the old earth whale trying to become a fish again after living as a land mammal are just the rare exception. Life moves on. It constantly finds new niches to invade.
Yeah, I said. Such as when humanity left old earth in its seed ships and Hawking drive vessels.
Not really, said Aenea. First of all, we did that prematurely because of the influence of the core and the fact that old earth was dying because of a black hole in its belly. Also the core's work. Secondly, because of the Hawking drive, we could jump through our arm of the galaxy to find Earth-like worlds high on the Solmev scale, most of which we terraformed anyway and seeded with old Earth life forms, starting with soil bacteria and earthworms and moving up to the ducks you used to hunt in the Hyperion fens.
I nodded. But I was thinking, how else should we have done it as a species moving out into space? What's wrong with going to places that looked and smelled somewhat like home, especially when home wasn't going to be there to go back to?
There's something more interesting in Vernadsky's observations and Dalo's Law, said Aenea.
What's that, kiddo?
I was still thinking about ducks. Life doesn't retreat.
How so?
As soon as I asked the question, I understood.
Yeah, said my friend, seeing my understanding.
As soon as life gets a foothold somewhere, it stays. You name it, Arctic cold, the old Mars frozen desert, boiling hot springs, a sheer rock face such as here on Tian Shan, even in autonomous intelligence programs. Once life gets its proverbial foot in the door, it stays forever.
So what are the implications of that? I said.
Simply that left to its own devices, which are clever devices, life will someday fill the universe, said Aenea. It will be a green galaxy to begin with, then off to our neighboring clusters and galaxies.
That's a disturbing thought, I said.
She paused to look at me. Why, Rawl? I think it's beautiful.
Green planets I've seen, I said. A green atmosphere is imaginable but weird.
She smiled. It doesn't have to be just plants. Life adapts. Birds, men and women in flying machines, you and me in paragliders, people adapted to flight.
That hasn't happened yet, I said. But what I meant was, well, to have a green galaxy, people and animals and...
And living machines, said Aenea, and androids, artificial life of a thousand forms.
Yeah, people, animals, machines, androids, whatever, would have to adapt to space. I don't see how...
We have, said Aenea, and more will before too long. We reached the next 300th step and paused to pant.
What other directions are there in evolution that we've ignored? I said when we began to climb again.
Increasing diversity and complexity, said Aenea. Scientists argued back and forth about these directions for centuries, but there's no doubt that evolution favors, in the very long run, both these attributes. And of the two, diversity is the more important.
Why? I said. She must have been growing tired of that syllable. I sounded like a 3-year-old child, even to myself.
Scientists used to think that basic evolutionary designs kept multiplying, said Aenea. That's called disparity. But that turned out not to be the case. Variety in basic plans tends to decrease as life's anti-entropic potential, evolution, increases. Look at all the orphans of old Earth, for instance. Same basic DNA, of course, but also the same basic plans. Evolved from forms with tubular guts, radial symmetry, eyes, feeding mouths, two sexes, pretty much from the same mold.
But I thought you said diversity was important, I said.
It is, said Aenea. But diversity is different than basic plan disparity. Once evolution gets a good basic design, it tends to throw away the variance and concentrate on the near-infinite diversity within that design. Thousands of related species, tens of thousands.
Trilobites, I said, getting the idea.
Yes, said Aenea, and when?
Beetles, I said. All those goddamn species of beetles.
Aenea grinned at me through her mask. Precisely, and when?
Bugs, I said. Every world I've been on has the same goddamn swarms of bugs, mosquitoes, endless varieties of...
You've got it, said Aenea. Life shifts into high gear when the basic plan for an organism is settled and new niches open up. Life settles into those new niches by tweaking the diversity within the basic shape of those organisms. New species. There are thousands of new species of plants and animals that have come into existence in just the last millennium since interstellar flight started. And not all bioengineered. Some just adapted at a furious rate to the new Earth-like worlds they were dumped down on.
Triaspens, I said, remembering just Hyperion. Everblues. Woman grove root. Tesla trees?
They were native, said Aenea.
So the diversity's good, I said, trying to find the original threads of this discussion.
Diversity's good, agreed Aenea. As I said, it lets life shift into high gear and get on with its mindless business of greening up the universe. But there's at least one old Earth species that hasn't diversified much at all, at least not on the friendly worlds it colonized.
Us, I said. Humans.
Aenea nodded grimly. We've been stuck in one species since our Cro-Magnon ancestors helped to wipe out the smarter Neanderthals, she said. Now it's our chance to diversify rapidly, and institutions like the Hegemony, the Pax, and the Core are stopping it.
Does the need to diversify extend to human institutions, I said? Religions, social systems?
I was thinking about the people who had helped me on Vitus Gray, Bolianus B, Demria, Demloa, and their families. I was thinking about the Amoyeti spectrum helix and its complicated and convoluted beliefs. Absolutely, said Aenea. Look over there.
Abetic had paused at a slab of marble, upon which words were carved in Chinese and early Web English. High rises the eastern peak, soaring up to the blue sky, among the rocks an empty hollow, secret still, mysterious, uncarved and unhewn, screened by nature with a roof of clouds. Time and seasons, what things are you? Bringing to my life ceaseless change. I will lodge forever in this hollow, where springs and autumns unheeded pass. Tao Yun, wife of General Wang Ning Chi, A.D. 400. We climbed on. I thought that I could see something red at the top of this next flight of stairs. The south gate of heaven and entry to the summit slope? It was about time. Wasn't that beautiful, though? I said, speaking of the poem. Isn't continuity like that as important or more important in human institutions as diversity? It's important, agreed Aenea. But that's almost all humanity has been doing for the last millennium, Rawl. Recreating old Earth institutions and ideas on different worlds. Look at the hegemony. Look at the church and the Pax. Look at this world. Tian Shan, I said. I think it's wonderful. So do I, said Aenea. But it's all borrowed. The Buddhism has evolved a bit, at least away from idolatry and ritual, back to the open-mindedness that was its earliest hallmark. But everything else is pretty much an attempt to recapture things lost with old Earth. Such as, I said. Such as the language, dress, the names of the mountains, local customs. Hell, Rawl, even this pilgrimage trail and the temple of the Jade Emperor, if we ever get there. You mean there is a Tai Shan mountain on old Earth? I said. Absolutely, said Aenea. With its own city of peace and heavenly gates and mouth of the dragon. Confucius climbed it more than 3,000 years ago. But the old Earth stairway had just 7,000 steps. I wish we'd climbed it instead, I said, wondering if I could keep climbing. The steps were short, but there had been a hell of a lot of them. I see your point, though. Aenea nodded. It's wonderful to preserve tradition, but a healthy organism evolves, culturally and physically. Which brings us back to evolution, I said. What are the other directions, tendencies, goals, or whatever that you said had been ignored the last few centuries? There are just a few more, said Aenea. One is an ever-increasing number of individuals. Life likes gazillions of species, but it absolutely loves hyper-gazillions of individuals. In a sense, the universe is tooled up for individuals. There was a book in the Taliesin Library called Evolving Hierarchical Systems by an old Earth guy named Stanley Southey. Did you see it? No, I must have missed it when I was reading those early 21st century hollow porn novels. Uh-huh, said Aenea. Well, Southey put it sort of neatly. An indefinite number of unique individuals can exist in a finite material world if they are nested within each other and that world is expanding. Nested within each other, I repeated, thinking about it. Yeah, I get it. Like the old Earth bacteria in our gut, and the paramecia we've dragged into space, and the other cells in our bodies. More worlds, more people, yeah. The trick is more people, said Aenea. We have hundreds of billions, but between the Fall and the Pax, the actual human population in the galaxy, not counting ousters, has leveled off in the last few hundred years. Well, birth control is important, I said, repeating what everyone on Hyperion had been taught. I mean, especially with the cruciform, capable of keeping people alive for centuries and centuries. Exactly, said Aenea. With artificial immortality comes more stagnation, physical and cultural. It's a given. I frowned. But that's not a reason to deny people the chance for extended life, is it? Aenea's voice seemed remote, as if she were contemplating something much larger. No, she said at last, not in itself. What are the evolutionary directions, I asked, seeing the red pagoda come closer above us and praying that the conversation would keep my mind off collapsing, rolling back down the 20-some-thousand steps we had climbed. Just three more worth mentioning, said Aenea.
increasing specialization, increasing codependency, and increasing evolvability. All of these are really important, but the last is most so.
How do you mean, kiddo?
I mean that evolution itself evolves. It has to. Evolvability is in itself an inherited survival trait. Systems, living and otherwise, have to learn how to evolve and, to some extent, control the direction and rate of their own evolution. The human species, we were on the verge of doing that 1,000 years ago, and the core took it away from us, at least from most of us.
What do you mean, most of us?
I promise that you'll see in a few days, Raw.
We reached the south gate of heaven and passed through its arched entry, a red arch under a golden pagoda roof. Beyond it was the heavenly way, a gentle slope that ran to the summit that was just visible. The heavenly way was nothing more than path on bare black rock. We could have been walking on an airless moon like old Earth's. The conditions here were about as amenable to life. I started to say something to Aenea about this being a niche that life hadn't stuck its foot into, when she led the way off the path to a small stone temple set in among the sharp crags and fissures a few hundred meters below the summit. There was an airlock that looked so ancient it appeared to have come out on one of the earliest seed ships. Amazingly, it worked when she activated the press pad, and the three of us stood in it until it cycled and the inner door opened. We stepped inside. It was a small room, and almost bare except for an ornate bronze pot holding fresh flowers, some sprigs of green on a low dais, and a beautiful statue, once gold, of a life-size woman in robes that appeared to be made of gold. The woman was fat-cheeked and of pleasant demeanor, a sort of female Buddha, and she looked to be wearing a gilded crown of leaves and had an oddly Christian halo of hammered gold behind her head. Abetic pulled off his helmet and said,
"The air is good. Air pressure more than adequate."
Aenea and I folded back our skin suit cowls. It was a pleasure to breathe regularly. There were incense tapers and a box of matches at the statue's foot. Aenea went to one knee and used a match to light one of the tapers. The smell of incense was very strong.
"This is the princess of the azure clouds," she said, smiling up at the smiling gold face. "The goddess of the dawn. By lighting this, I've just made an offering for the birth of grandchildren."
I started to smile and then froze. She has a child. My beloved has already had a child. My throat tightened and I looked away, but Aenea walked over and took my arm.
"Shall we eat lunch?" she said.
I had forgotten about our brown bag lunch. It would have been difficult to eat it through our helmets and osmosis masks. We sat in the dim light, in the windowless room, amid the floating smoke and scent of incense, and ate the sandwiches packed by the monks.
"Where now?" I said, as Aenea began recycling the inner lock.
"I have heard that there is a precipice on the eastern edge of the summit called Suicide Cliff," said Abetic. "It used to be a place for serious sacrifice. Jumping from it is said to provide instant communion with the Jade Emperor and to ensure that your offering request is honored. If you really want to guarantee grandchildren, you might jump from there."
I stared at the android. I was never sure if he had a sense of humor or simply a skewed personality. Aenea laughed.
"Let's walk to the temple of the Jade Emperor first," she said. "See if anyone's home."
Outside, I was struck first by the isolation of the skin suit and the airless clarity of everything. The osmosis mask had gone almost opaque because of the unfiltered ferocity of the midday sun at this altitude. Shadows were harsh. We were about 50 meters from the summit and the temple when a form stepped out of the blackness of shadow behind a boulder and blocked our way. I thought, "Shrike," and foolishly clenched my hands into fists before I saw what it was. A very tall man stood before us, dressed in lance-slashed vacuum combat armor. Standard Pax Fleet Marine and Swiss Guard issue. I could see his face through the impact-proof visor. His skin was black, his features strong, and his short-cropped hair was white. There were fresh and livid scars on his dark face.
His eyes were not friendly. He was carrying a Marine-class multi-purpose assault rifle, and now he raised it and leveled it at us. His transmission was on the skin suit band.
Stop!
We stopped. The giant did not seem to know what to do next. The packs finally have us, was my first thought. Aeneas took a step forward. Sergeant Gregorius? Came her voice on the skin suit band. The man cocked his head but did not lower the weapon. I had no doubt that the rifle would work perfectly in hard vacuum. Either Fleshette Cloud, Energy Lance, Charged Particle Beam, Solid Slug, or Hyper K. The muzzle was aimed at my beloved's face.
How do you know my...
began the giant, and then seemed to rock backward.
You're her. The one. The girl we sought for so long across so many systems. Aeneas.
Yes, said Aeneas. Are there others who survived?
Three,
said the man she had called Gregorius. He gestured to his right, and I could just make out a black scar on black rock, with blackened remnants of something that might have been a starship escape bulb.
Is Father Captain DeSoya among them? Said Aeneas.
I remembered the name. I remembered DeSoya's voice on the dropship radio when he had found us and saved us from Nemes and then let us go on God's Grove almost 10 of his and Aeneas' years ago.
Aye, said Sergeant Gregorius. The captain's alive, but just barely. He was burned bad on the poor old Raphael. He'd be Adams with her if he hadn't passed out and given me the opportunity to drag him to a lifeboat. The other two are hurt, but the father captain's dying.
He lowered the rifle and leaned on it wearily.
Dying the true death. We have no resurrection creche, and the darling father captain made me promise to slag him to Adams when he went, rather than let him be resurrected a mindless idiot.
Aeneas nodded.
Can you take me to him? I need to talk to him.
Gregorius shouldered the heavy weapon and looked suspiciously at Abetic and me.
And these two?
This is my dear friend, said Aeneas, touching Abetic's arm.
She took my hand.
And this is my beloved.
The giant only nodded at this, turned and led the way up the final stretch of slope to the summit, to the temple of the Jade Emperor. Part 3. Chapter 22. On Hyperion, several hundred light-years toward galactic center from the events and the people on Tian Shan, a forgotten old man rose out of the dreamless sleep of long-term cryogenic fugue and slowly became aware of his surroundings. His surroundings were a no-touch suspension bed, a gaggle of life-support modules encircling him and nuzzling him like so many feeding raptors, and uncountable tubes, wires, and umbilicals finishing their work of feeding him, detoxifying his blood, stimulating his kidneys, carrying antibiotics to fight infection, monitoring his life signs, and generally invading his body and dignity in order to revive him and keep him alive.
Fuck! Rasped the old man. Waking up is a fucking goddamn dung-eating, corpse-buggering shitstorm of a nightmare for the terminally old. I'd pay a million marks if I could just get out of bed and go piss.
And good morning to you, M. Silenus, said the female android, monitoring the old poet's life signs on the floating biomonitor. You seem to be in good spirits today.
Bugger all blue-skinned wenches, mumbled Martin Silenus. Where are my teeth?
You haven't grown them back yet, M. Silenus, said the android. She was named A. Radic, and was a little over 3 centuries old, less than 1/3 the age of the ancient human mummy floating in the suspension bed.
No need to, mumbled the old man. Won't fucking be awake long enough. How long was I under?
2 years, 3 months, 8 days. Said A. Radic. Martin Silenus peered up at the open sky above his tower.
The canvas roof on this highest level of his stone turret had been rolled back. Deep lapis blue. The low light of early morning or late evening. The shimmer and flit of radiant gossamers not yet illuminating their fragile half-meter butterfly wings.
"What season?"
managed Silenus. "Late spring," said the female android. Other blue-skinned servants of the old poet moved in and out of the circular room, bent on obscure errands. Only A. Radic monitored the last stages of the poet's revival from fugue.
"How long since they left?"
He did not have to specify who the they were. A. Radic knew that the old poet meant not only Rall Endymion, the last visitor to their abandoned university city, but the girl Aenea, whom Silenus had known 3 centuries earlier, and whom he still hoped to see again some day.
9 years, 8 months, 1 week, 1 day, said A. Radic. All Earth standard, of course.
Urgh, grunted the old poet.
He continued peering at the sky. The sunlight was filtered through canvas rolled to the east, pouring light onto the south wall of the stone turret, while not striking him directly. But the brightness still brought tears to his ancient eyes.
"I've become a thing of darkness," he mumbled, "like Dracula, rising from my fucking grave every few years to check on the world of the living."
"Yes, M. Silenus," agreed A. Radic, changing several settings on the control panel.
"Shut up, wench," said the poet.
"Yes, M. Silenus."
The old man moaned.
"How long until I can get into my hover chair, Radic?"
The hairless android pursed her lips.
2 more days, M. Silenus. Perhaps 2 and a half.
"Aw, hell and damn," muttered Martin Silenus. "Recovery gets slower each time. One of these times I won't wake at all. The fugue machinery won't bring me back."
"Yes, M. Silenus," agreed the android. "Each cold sleep is harder on your system. The resuscitation and life support equipment is quite old. It is true that you will not survive many more awakenings."
"Oh, shut up," growled Martin Silenus. "You are a morbid, gloomy old bitch."
"Yes, M. Silenus."
"How long have you been with me, Radic?"
241 years, 11 months, 19 days, said the android. "Standard."
"And you still haven't learned to make a decent cup of coffee?"
"No, M. Silenus."
"But you have put a pot on, correct?"
"Yes, M. Silenus, as per your standing instructions."
"Fucking A," said the poet.
"But you will not be able to ingest liquids orally for at least another 12 hours, M. Silenus," said A. Radic.
"Arr," said the poet.
"Yes, M. Silenus."
After several minutes in which it looked like the old man had drifted back to sleep, Martin Silenus said,
"Any word from the boy or child?"
"No, sir," said A. Radic. "But then, of course, we only have access to the in-system PAX comm network these days, and most of their new encrypting is quite good."
"Any gossip about them?"
"Not that we are sure of, M. Silenus," said the android. "Things are very troubled for the PAX. Revolution in many systems, problems with their outback crusade against the ousters, a constant movement of warships and troopships within the PAX boundaries. And there is talk of the viral contagion, highly coded and circumspect."
"The contagion," repeated Martin Silenus, and smiled a toothless smile. "The child, I would guess."
"Quite possibly, M. Silenus," said A. Radic. "Although it is quite possible that there is a real viral plague on those worlds where..."
"No," said the poet, shaking his head almost violently. "It's Aenea, and her teachings, spreading like the Beijing flu. You don't remember the Beijing flu, do you, Radic?"
"No, sir," said the female, finishing her check of the readouts and setting the module to auto. "That was before my time. It was before anyone's time. Anyone but you, sir."
Normally, there would have been some obscene outburst from the poet, but now he merely nodded.
"I know. I'm a freak of nature,"
Pay you 2 bits and come into the sideshow. See the oldest man in the galaxy. See the mummy that walks and talks. Sort of. See the disgusting thing that refuses to die. Bizarre, aren't I, Erratic?
Yes, M. Silenus.
The poet grunted.
Well, don't get your hopes up, blue thing. I'm not going to croak until I hear from Rollin and Nia. I have to finish the Kantos, and I don't know the ending until they create it for me. How do I know what I think until I see what they do?
Precisely, M. Silenus.
Don't humor me, blue woman.
Yes, M. Silenus.
The boy, Rawl, asked me what his orders were almost 10 years ago. I told him, save the child, Aenea. Topple the packs, destroy the church's power, and bring the earth back from wherever the fuck it went. He said he'd do it. Of course he was stinking drunk with me at the time.
Yes, M. Silenus.
Well, said the poet.
Well, what, sir? Said Erratic.
Well, any sign of him having done any of the things he's promised, Radic?
We know from the Pax's transmissions 9 years and 8 months ago that he and the consul's ship escaped Hyperion, said the android. We can hope that the child Aenea is still safe and well.
Yes, yes, muttered Silenus, waving his hand feebly. But is the Pax toppled?
Not that we can notice, M. Silenus, said Radic. There were the mild troubles I mentioned earlier, and off-world born-again tourism here on Hyperion is down a bit, but...
And the sodding church is still in the zombie business?
Demanded the poet, his thin voice stronger now.
The church remains ascendant, said Erratic. More of the moor people and the mountain people accept the cruciform every year.
Bugger all, said the poet. I don't suppose that the earth has returned to its proper place.
We have not heard of that improbability occurring, said Erratic. Of course, as I mentioned, our electronic eavesdropping is restricted to in-system transmissions these days, and since the consul's ship left with M. Endymion and M. Aenea almost 10 years ago, our decryption capabilities have not been...
all right, said the old man, sounding terribly tired again. Get me into my hover chair.
Not for another 2 days at least, I am afraid, repeated the android, her voice gentle.
Piss up a rope, said the ancient figure, floating amid tubes and sensor wires. Can you wheel me over to a window, Radic? Please? I want to look at the spring chalma trees and the ruins of this old city.
Yes, M. Silenus, said the android, sincerely pleased to be doing something for the old man, besides keeping his body working. Martin Silenus watched out the window for 1 full hour, fighting the tides of reawakening pain and the terrible sleepy urge to return to fugue state. It was morning light. His audio implants relayed the birdsong to him. The old poet thought of his adopted young niece, the child who had decided to call herself Aenea. He thought of his dear friend, Braun Lamia, Aenea's mother. How they had been enemies for so long, had hated each other during parts of that last great Shrike pilgrimage so long ago. About the stories they had told one another, and the things they had seen. The Shrike in the Valley of the Time Tombs, its red eyes blazing. The scholar. What was his name? Saul. Saul and his little swaddled brat aging backward to nothing. And the soldier. Kassad, that was it, Colonel Kassad.